I spent 3 years at a boarding school in Toowoomba. And in the last year, the Sputnik went around. It was at night, and we all had to go out and lay down, and no speaking, and look at the heavens and see if we could find Sputnik on laying on the oval in the middle of the night.
Did you see it?
I think so. Everyone got excited, they thought it, but I think my imagination might have taken off, and I think I saw something move, but I'm not sure. I was in the Royal Australian Navy, and I'd finished my 9 year stint on January in 1968, and I tried to get a job at a Royal Valley as a technician, but I didn't make the grade, and then I left the Navy, and then I applied for a job at Honeysuckle, and they gave me a job. They ummed and ahed a bit because I was a chief petty officer in the Navy, and I was a technical person, but my skill range was on World War II type equipment. And here we are in the late 60s, and technology had moved on a fair bit. And when I got to Honeysuckle, I realised that, and they gave me a job as the lowest grade technician. I'm very thankful for it. They gave me a chance. And then in the next year, in that year, 1968, I realised that I was a bit behind in the technology. I decided with my wife that we'd invest in my future for the family. And so I decided to go back to college. And I did a tech course for 4 years, starting in 1969. And then after that, the tertiary education under the Whitlam government became free. And here was a chance that people like me, who didn't even finish high school, had a chance. So I applied to the ANU to do a science degree, but as I never finished high school, that didn't eventuate. So then I went over to the Canberra College Advanced Education, which is today is called, I think, the University of Canberra. Yeah, and by this time I'm pretty keen to do this. We decided that we'd give it a go. This is a dream for any person who, with my background. So I remember they initially knocked me back, but I went in and saw a professor in the head of the science faculty. And I had a meeting with him, and I put all my cards on the table. And he was the same as the ANU. He said, well, you know, these are the rules. So I challenged him to give me a go, and he took it up. I did a science degree, applied science. So all this happened when I was at Honeysuckle.
Yeah, so at Honeysuckle from 68 until when?
Oh, it would have been, well, I did at least 4, 3, 7, probably 8 years. I just forget, 8. No, 77, probably about 1978 or 79. Yeah. And I spent 4 and 4, probably 8, 9 years at night school. And as Honeysuckle said, they were good enough to give me time off, not for lectures and that, but to do exams. And I had to make up the rest because, as I was told, and quite rightly, that they were not an education facility. They were in this business, and I appreciated it. And it was good for both of us, both for the company that ran them as contractors, and I got a science degree out of it in the end.
So you were at Honeysuckle into the deep space era.
Yes, yes, we moved out to deep space, and I stayed there for a few years, and then I took a job in the with Sperry Univac at the time, a computer company at the US.
Well, just to think back to Apollo 11 for a minute, yeah. You were at SUDS on the day. Do you want to tell us what was SUDS, what did it do, and what were you doing there?
Well, the SDDS is an acronym. It's all acronyms. But in the SDDS was System Data Demodulator something. I forget what the final S was. It stripped the data, the raw data, off the subcarriers that were on the carrier that came down from the spacecraft. So the receiver's tuned in into the carrier, the subcarriers were sent across to my area, and the data, the raw data, was then sent downstream for processing. It's to a lay person, it's probably a bit difficult to explain, but it's not sort of like picking oranges. You don't sort of get a subcarrier and strip all the bits off it and put them in a bin and send the bin down there. It's not like that. It's all automated. You know, it's when receivers lock up, green lights come on, and then the you're connected to the output of the receivers, and then the demodulators lock up and the green lights come again, and then it's automatic. The data will be on the line going downstream to the next processing stage. The also, that was the data. We also handled the voice that came in on the voice lines, went through the station, and then up to subcarriers throughout. We had to have the facility to be able to switch it to different transmitters. So that was the reason why it came to my area. And then they went up to the spacecraft. The voice came down, got stripped off subcarriers, and then put onto the line and sent off the station. So we handled the voice and the data. All the data, including there was the television came down, and that had to be the video signal had to be stripped off and sent down for processing. So all this stuff, all this connectivity to the receivers and to the back end, all came through the area that I worked in.
Right. So there are many different ways of interconnecting everything.
There were, and it haunted me for years that you see. When the receivers announce that they have AOS, acquisition of signal, the operations people would automatically see the green lights come up, and then they see the DMODs lock up, and then the decommutators in the processing area would all light up and the data would get online. It's all automatic. It all happens bang, 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 mm-hmm. within seconds. You know, it's all instantaneous, really. But on Apollo 11, it wasn't. I must confess, it was when I heard, I think it was John Saxon or someone in ops, start to query the telemetry section, where was the data, that I'd realised that we weren't configured correctly.
So this was for the EVA, or
is
this...
Oh, no, this is the initial acquisition of the signal.
Okay, this was with a LEM on the surface at about 11:15 in the morning as it came over the hill. Yeah.
And then I'd realised that there was an error in quotes in our configuration, because we had a lot of people trialling different things and testing things. And we corrected it, and then it was all... He didn't even have time to answer before it came good. But there was probably about a pregnant pause of about a couple of seconds, which I'd prefer not to forget, not to remember. But anyhow, that's been brutally honest. I don't even think they answered. It locked up, and then they just continued on normally. Mm. And would have said something like, I wonder what that was.
So you had a couple of hours.
Yep.
Had an hour, had about an hour and a half after acquisition before the moonwalk started.
That was also rather interesting, because I don't think they foresaw what would happen naturally when the guy was about to step on the moon. when he was about to, everyone sort of started to leave their positions and go down to the video to have a look, which could be disastrous. So they were told to stay in their positions. They wouldn't get a go to have a look. I had to. I couldn't leave because, you know, there's a lot of balls in the air there at that time. But what we did was, what I did was to configure our oscilloscope. Your oscilloscope to a technician is a bit like a stethoscope is to a doctor. You know, you can't. You just need it. You know, everything you did, nearly, except for voice, you needed it to be able to look at signals and their levels, all the rest of the stuff. And so we configured our... the theory says that you can turn the... You make an oscilloscope do anything, really.
Mm.
And so we rigged it up to and look through a visor so that we looked like we were really looking at the dust. But when we actually were looking at the TV signal in black and green, because it that was, you know, we'd get the signal would appear as a green traces on our scopes, and the background was dark. So, and then we had to invert to get it right, and the synchronization had to be manual. We had to vary the vertical and the horizontal frequencies to make it stand still. All this sort of stuff. That's how I saw them first step on the moon on my oscilloscope, twiddling the knobs to trying to get it steady.
Now, Suds was just around the corner, wasn't it, from the survo console? It wasn't that far from everybody else.
The servo console was right to the right of us, only a couple of metres.
Right, and then the video was sort of back behind you and to the left somewhere?
The video was down into the telemetry section.
Down the building.
A bit further down. It would see, there was a timing system. It's a bit funny. The timing system then consisted of two clocks, digital clocks, and its frequency sources, the atomic standards. The whole lot today, forget the frequency sources, but the digital side of it, you got more power in the wristwatch than you had in these four or five cabinets that stood probably in the old money, about 5 foot high. To produce a digital clock. Quite amazing.
Yeah, and that was part of the ranging system, was it?
The ranging system, well, there's a beast that I always stood in awe of. I did a course on it years later, and what always fascinated me about the Mark 1A ranging system was the technology. It wasn't digital. It was a sort of an alien beast that it had a section in it called the Chinese number generator.
This is with the pseudo random code, is it?
Yeah. To produce what was called the pseudo random noise codes, the Chinese number generator, and all in germanium, absolutely amazing, and no flip flops or digital basic things that are so basic to our digital world today. None of that, the ley lines, and you know, a sort of a hybrid between analog and digital. A strange beast, if ever there was one. If it was a horse, it would be a unicorn.
So you watched the television on your oscilloscope?
On my oscilloscope.
Was there anybody else in SADS with you?
Not that I remember. Not that I remember.
You had signals coming in from the honeysuckle antenna, from Tidbinbilla, the wing, and from Parkes as well.
Yes, we those three sources, yep. The theory said that the signal from Parkes should have a better signal-to-noise ratio. That's what the theory said. Sometime later in the later Apollos, I think they, not too sure whether they used the big antenna at Tidbinbilla or not. But that would have been better because they had a better front-end amplifier.
Oh, yes, they had a Maser, did they?
Yeah. And that was why their signal from the wing site was marginally better than the one from Honeysuckle.
And was that the reason that Tidbinbilla was originally slated to be pointed at the LEM, but it had to be swapped because they had a fire?
Probably. It was in theory the best signal, and the test proved that it was. And then the Parkes had a couple of dBs up its sleeve with the antenna. All those details we didn't sort of get involved with because I had to look after my area. And you cannot afford to be minding someone else's business or going ooh-ah and following that. You have to mind what you did, just like a team, just like a football game. You can't be worrying what they're doing in the scrum if you're a fly half. Everyone had to do their job and only do their job. And I can remember there would have been, looking back on it, I didn't realise it then, you know, I was only in my 20s. There would have been a political angle too attached to using Parkes data, but eventually we used it. I think it was a bit ropey at first. There was all the testing we did. I knew that there was a thing called the bounce at West Orange. I have no idea where the video signal went physically. All I know is it came out a hole in the wall in my area, and it had a label on it, Parkes. How it got there, I really didn't care too much. Yeah, things were a bit ropey, and even sometimes when we did the test, you were sitting there, you'd see the test signals come down the video line, and suddenly they'd all disappear off your oscilloscope And then it all settled back down again, and people would say, hell, what was that? You know, by the time they tried to investigate it. I had visions of clotheslines tracking through central New South Wales, you know what I mean? With wires strung between them and then going underground here and someone ploughing them up and all that sort of stuff.
So just thinking back to, well, maybe the feel or the atmosphere, did you go into the day on the 21st of July thinking this is the day? Or was it just another working day?
Well, of all the testing we did, to me, in my youth, I used to do a bit of boxing. And really, on that day, it was like climbing into the ring. I knew it had to be done. I sat on the stool. My seconds talked to me. And, you know, I sort of creaked my neck a bit and wobbled my feet, and I knew it had to be done. And, of course, you know, we'd been through it that many times. It was almost automatic. So you couldn't sort of put too much emotion into it. You had to just do what you've been drilled to do, what was expected. We'd been through it countless times.
Mm.
So really it was automatic, and it was just a matter of playing it out.
So where did it go next after you?
First off, it had to be recorded. All that stuff had to be recorded.
On the M22 recorders?
Yeah, all that stuff. And then went into the decommutators where all the frames were stripped out and then sent down to the computers, who then formatted it and put it all in the right slots, and then it would be shipped onto the lines in real time over to Mission Control. So, you know, they saw all their backpack data and all that stuff all came down. That came down, oddly enough, on voice subcarriers, I think, from memory. So that had to be stripped off and the data taken off yet more subcarriers. You had the carrier, you had a voice subcarrier, you had all this PLSS. That was on subcarriers again, and then the data had to be stripped off them. So it was a bit like a Russian doll. You open it up, and oh, there's something, another one. You open it up, oh, there's another one. And then finally you got down and stripped the data off the last one. This was high tech. This was high octane, really. You know, and missions later, when they're trying to squeeze dBs out of everything. You know, they needed more. They had to get rid of the slow scan and, you know, increase the speed of the video. So they had to have squeeze a dB here, a dB there. If you can get 4 or 5 dBs due to an antenna, you take it. So that allowed them to increase the rate. Even the demodulator got rehacked. Motorola in the US devised another one, and they sent out a guy to install it over at our site. You know, and a young bloke too. You know, he was my age, and he was the designer, which made me sit back and think. quite amazing, really. Well, the guy that came over with the Motorola prototype to redesign the whole demod section to strip the video off the receiver IF. He was, as I said, in his 20s. And it was all the breadboard, the stuff we used to do at uni when you had to do experiments. You know, you had to put it all together on a breadboard and see if it worked, you know, and if it didn't, you can rewire a bit here and that's what it came out as, on a breadboard. And he said, oh, yeah, this should work, and it did, and that was that. So he left and done his job, and eventually they got better video. They all contributed a little bit.
Were you aware during the moonwalk that Honeysuckle's video had been used for the start of the TV, or did you just find out later on?
Not really. I only found out later on. If they put something to line that was worse than what was online, they'd look a bit silly, wouldn't they? So you've got to look at the signal and trying to make a comparative analysis of what would be the best signal. And so you upset the liaise with me a bit, because I could see the video from the wing side, I can see it from Honeysuckle, I can see it from Parks. So, and even though I think even they came down, had a look. Because, you know, I can understand the pressure they were under.
So you could actually see the video where you were coming from the other sides as well?
I could see the video signals. You know, it didn't come up as TV. It's the raw signal.
Yeah, but you could judge the quality of the signal.
Well, you get good at it after a while. You know, you can see things that are better than others. You're using the same oscilloscope, and you just put them side by side and say, well, that one looks better. You know, it looks less noisy. So you can do a visual comparison But they would have looked a bit silly if they said, here's from Parks, and it was worse. Whoops, it dropped out again, and it's being relayed all over the world. So I can understand the pressure they were under.
I mean, Honeysuckle didn't really expect to have the first step, so no. It was quite an unexpected privilege.
It was. It was a bonus, really. The you know, I understand them taking Goldstone. That would have been only natural. You know, it's a local station to them, and their networks are just there, and, you know, there's a lot of pluses if they're taking Goldstone.
No satellite hops or anything?
The poor video tech at Goldstone, he must have had a nightmare. I can understand his predicament.
Well, it's real-time stuff, isn't it?
There it is. There's no room for error. Hmm. I thought we did quite well. We punched above our weight that day.